All right, we're in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 this evening. We're in the middle of this final section where Paul is engaged in a vigorous defense of his apostleship. He's coming hard at his critics. And in chapter 11, in verse 30, we find a thought that really helps us see that, you know, in comparison to chapter 12, the subject matter really hasn't changed. He's talking a lot about his weakness, and he has a purpose for doing that. He's touting the many things that he's gone through, but for the purpose of basically showing that it is not by his strength. He makes no claims to be great in and of himself. His greatness, the greatness of his work, if any would deem it great, that greatness should be attributed to the Lord and not to Paul. So there have been these sundry accusations against Paul, insinuations against Paul. The Corinthians have begun to gobble that up a little bit, buy into that. And so Paul reluctantly has been addressing that. And so we see this language 11:30, if I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. The language of boasting and the language of weakness continues here into chapter 12. And so with that, would like a volunteer, we got a couple of mics back here, need someone to read for us the first 10 verses of chapter 12, please. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 1 through 10. And we have a volunteer. We got somebody. Oh, yeah, down here. Okay.
It is necessary to boast, though it is not profitable, but I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago, whether in the body I do not know or out of the body I don't know, God knows, such a man was caught up in the third heaven. And I know how such a man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know, God knows, was caught up into paradise and heard inexpressible words, which a man is not permitted to speak. On behalf of such a man, I will boast, but on my own behalf, I will not boast, except in weaknesses. For I do not wish to boast, I will not be foolish, for I will be speaking the truth, but I refrain from this, so that no one will consider me beyond what he sees in me or hears from me. Because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me, to keep me from exalting myself. Concerning this, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might leave me, and he has said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast in my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well contented with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions and hardships, for the sake of Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong.
All right. Thank you, Curtis. You see Paul's hesitancy? Verse 1. I must go on boasting. You ever, this may be a dated reference. You ever written a letter to someone and as you're writing it, you're having these inner thoughts that don't make it onto the paper? Almost having a conversation with yourself, well, should I say it this way or this way? I kind of get a little bit of that here, where Paul is actually inspired to record some of those thoughts that might not in other letters have made it in there. So here's the parenthetical thought. Not I must go on boasting, but this part. Though there is nothing to be gained by it, I can see him sighing that to himself. Why the discomfort about this? What he's terming boasting, we know he's talking about his apostleship. He's kind of been forced into this. Why is he reluctant? He's not an arrogant man. It's not how he's wired. to talk so much about himself. He'd much rather talk about others, and but actually he is doing this for others. You know, in what respect would there be nothing to be gained by it? I mean, he would say that from the standpoint of, as you said, Dick, it could be perceived as arrogance, could be perceived as self-serving, and that wouldn't be, you know, something that he would take any sense of pride in. This isn't about gaining anything for himself. However, he does acknowledge that it is profitable. Let me look at a different translation on here. Somebody have a different rendering of verse 1? Want to just read verse 1? I know you don't have the mic, but go ahead. I have the New American Standard here. Boasting is necessary, though it is not profitable. Boasting, I must go on boasting, though there is nothing to be gained by it. Paul is concerned, bottom line, about what is to be gained that is worthwhile to be gained. There is something to be gained from this, from the standpoint of he's defending his apostleship, he's defending the gospel, and by extension, that is profitable for them. That language, the word profitable in the New American Standard caught my attention because Paul uses that word quite a bit in his writings. Can you think of a place where Paul uses the word profitable? Yeah, you can get your little Bible app and do the search right now. And that's okay. That's what I did. Like, how many times does he use that? It's quite a few. 2 Timothy 3:16, all scripture is inspired by God and profitable for multiple things. Godliness, 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 8, godliness is profitable for all things. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 12, all things are lawful, but not all things are, again, this specific rendering, not all things are profitable. We need to be concerned about what is profitable. Paul had on his heart what is really needful. A similar thought in Ephesians 4 about our speech. Consider what is needful for the moment. Acts 20 and verse 20. Paul says to the elders of the Ephesian church, how I did not shrink from declaring to you anything that was profitable, anything and everything that would profit them spiritually. That's what Paul was interested in. And he understands in engaging in this, you know, you're running the risk. Okay, what he's I'm sure saying, writing this with a prayer on his lips and just praying to God, let this be profitable, because certainly Paul is doing this for the Lord. You notice then when he gets into sharing this vision, I have generally concluded that the individual referenced in verse 3 is talking about Paul, that Paul is the one who was caught up into the third heaven, that he was the one that heard things that man is not permitted to speak. He was the one who was exposed to a surpassing greatness of revelation. And it is a little awkward, though, to see Paul writing in the third person. Why do you think he resorts to the third person? Now, maybe you have a completely different take on this. I'm okay. Say that one more time. He said he wasn't going to boast, right? So if he starts, yeah, maybe he's trying to head off potential accusations. Shannon?
Also describes it as an out-of-body experience. So
it might
make sense in that respect to describe it in the third person.
Right, right. Almost as if part of him had left the building, right? Has been transported elsewhere. Would be a out-of-body experience, certainly a life-changing experience. And other than here, I mean, he doesn't write about it anywhere else, to my knowledge. Probably was very uncomfortable talking about it I would surmise, to very many people. It was not something he would just engage in eagerly. He was, I mean, all of this, I mean, we get a sense of Paul that as driven as he is, as on fire he is for the Lord, he doesn't want it to ever be about himself. We see that in 1 Corinthians, we see that in 2 Corinthians. Good thought about the vision. Other thoughts about that? I just, again, it's a curiosity, part of Bible study. You always ask, okay, why is this here? And try to wrestle with that question. one of the answers to why, Paul is given, there's this spiritual danger lurking that accompanies this vision that Paul identifies. What's the spiritual danger lurking where Paul is concerned? Okay, there was a danger in this of him becoming conceited, okay? Which is kind of part and parcel of what, you know, these false teachers are kind of trying to paint Paul as someone whom he's not, someone who's in it for himself, someone who is arrogant. So anyway, so verse 6, is it verse 6? Where are my readers at? There they are. Though if I should wish to boast, I would not be a fool, for I would be speaking the truth. But I refrain from it so that no one may think more of me than he sees in me or hears from me. That last part of verse 6 could also be part of the why he's choosing to speak of himself in this way. In addition to, as Shannon pointed out, the nature of this, the impact of this revelation on Paul's person, Paul also doesn't want, this is similar language to 1 Corinthians chapter, I think it's chapter 3 or chapter 4. I think it's chapter 4, verse 6. So that no one may think more of me than he sees in me or hears from me. In 1 Corinthians 4, the language is so that you may learn in us not to think beyond what is written. So this is about, ultimately about the Corinthians thinking. Everything that Paul does is intentional. Everything is measured. Everything is deliberate. So, bottom line, answer this. Why does Paul choose to share this? Call it a revelation. Call it an experience. Why does he choose to share it at all? Beyond the fact that he's concluded he must continue boasting. Kind of bounce that forward. Okay, so why that? Why does he share this at all, do you think?
Because he doesn't have a choice.
Because he doesn't have a choice? Hand him a mic. Or Cole's in the same row, too. He doesn't know why. Okay, elaborate real quick, Jesse. Not to put you on the spot. Why does he feel like he doesn't have a choice?
Because they're not respecting his apostleship. He's saying, okay, if there's like one last thing that will prove to you that I am worthy of being listened to over these other people, here it is. And even says so in verse 11, you forced me to it.
That's right. Yeah, you forced me to. He feels compelled to. He's being very thorough here. He's exhausting all measures at his disposal. This one seems to be one of the last things, if not the last thing that he's resorting to. Cole?
Just to add on to more what Jesse was saying, I 100% agree with you saying, but I think another perspective I take of it too is like, it's coming straight from his mouth, and he was the one who experienced it. So there's no, like, I could also see like people, you know, adding their own detail when they spread it. Because you know how like you tell a story and then you tell someone else's story and then they tell it. It changes by the time it, you know, that just, it's not like meant to, a lot of people don't mean to change it. It's just what they remember, right? Yeah. So maybe also just hearing it from his mouth, like, okay, it was this thing, and this is what happened. And I'm trying to just, like, keep it at that. And that's my identity as an apostle. So
yeah, good point. He's not exactly trying to embellish this. I mean, had one of his critics had this experience and shared it, you think you could have gone on several paragraphs maybe describing everything that was seen. It is kind of odd that he shared it in the first place. Well, equally as odd, just how succinct he is about it, right? This happened, as you say. What did you hear? Well, man's not permitted to speak, what did you see? Great and awesome things, It's like, okay, tell us more. So back to Paul's purpose for doing this. His boasting differs from that of his accusers, from that of his critics. In what ways is that true? Or maybe you could sum it up in one sentence. I kind of like the Jim Whidden rule. It's going to become to know. If you have more than one sentence, you need the microphone. I like that. Any thoughts about that? How does Paul's boasting differ from that of his critics? Scott.
Well, I think it. I'm thinking about our Lord's teaching in some things, but Paul, by bringing this example up, is showing that he's been commended by God. In other words, he's not boasting himself, but God has approved him, and God has shown that. And I'm telling you my experience and what has happened and the revelation given to me, but it's not because I'm something special. It's because God has commended me, to do that.
Yeah.
But these false teachers, they're boasting of themselves. They're the ones that are putting themselves forward.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul's kind of talking about his experience in a way to, again, defend his apostleship. But really, ultimately, all these things he's showing is showing that God has approved of him, and God is putting him forward, not I'm putting myself forward, but it's just far different than the false teacher.
Yeah, when Paul comes out on the other side of this vision or series of visions that he has, I mean, he's worse off. In some way, physically, I assume he has this thorn, whatever it is, and I know there are all kinds of ideas about what that is. That aside, I mean, it's his. If his thorn is indeed, maybe it's one of the very physical limitations that has served to spawn these accusations against Paul, right? Maybe it's a speech impediment. I'm just throwing that out. I don't necessarily think that's what it was. But it's, sharing this the way he did really wouldn't have made Paul. He didn't really do a great job if the goal was to make himself, to prop himself up. But that gets to your point. The critics, their motive was to boast in a way as to make themselves look good. Why does Paul boast? To make the Lord Jesus Christ look good and to have it reflect on him. The one that comes out shining in this story is not in the relating of this experience is not Paul, it is Christ. Yeah, go ahead.
So I just to play maybe devil's advocate, because like when Paul says this thing happened to him, I feel like tons of people in society say that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, God told me to do this. Like, I was literally watching this is the treehouse show, the guy who builds all these treehouses or whatever. There's this guy who built this massive treehouse, and he's like, yeah, God told me to build this treehouse for his people. And it's like, people say that all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I don't see that being as like a, yeah, I believe you on that for me.
Right.
Just because it's just said so much. But I think he finishes it, which is kind of where Jesse was getting at earlier, is when he says like, hey, my signs when I was with you, you saw that.
Yeah.
So I feel like that ultimately is, for me, what would change that statement for me. Like if I was with him and I saw him and he did all those things.
Yeah.
And then he's saying this, like, and yeah, and this happened to me. Here's this quick detail about it.
Right.
That makes it a little more powerful.
Yeah,
but I just, more just perspective, like when people say that or Paul says that, I find it kind of interesting because it's like
right.
Joseph Smith did the same thing.
Right.
It's like there's so many false teachers who've done that exact same thing.
Right.
But they didn't live like what Christ or set his example, which was what he kind of pleased to at the end of this.
Right. The evidence that Paul has previously, I mean, that has been at their disposal for all these years, that's the real compelling proof, as you both have alluded to. We'll get into this. Paul's a little frustrated that he's even having to do this at all. But again, so this, the sharing of this revelation about the thorn could possibly put his potentially, I'm just throwing this out as a Bible study thought, might have the benefit of putting whatever perceived imperfections people assigned to Paul in perspective. But most importantly, they would come out on the other side of this thinking, okay, look at what God has been able to do. Okay, let me pivot real quick. I want you to think about we could make this a lengthy discussion. We just can't for the sake of time. But I want you to think about your limitations, not someone else's, yours. Is it a physical limitation? Is it a financial limitation? Would you indeed describe it as a thorn that you did not ask for? What are yours? How do I respond to those limitations? I'll tell you what I think Paul would do, and we know this not just from this writing, but in places like Philippians chapter 1. He's sitting in prison and is just exuding this unbelievable optimism. It really is believable. And it's almost as if Paul gets thrown into a situation, it's like, oh goody, I wonder what the Lord will do with this. I can't wait to find out. Not that every moment was joyous for him. But I mean, don't we see that over and over again with Paul? Acts 16, they're in the jail. They've been beaten. They're singing hymns to God. You can't fake that. What are your thorns? What are your other limitations? And how do you view them? How do you respond to them? That's a compelling thought, I think, for us to meditate on day by day. Is my first inclination to gripe about, I wish things were this way or this way or this way? Or could I look at this through a completely different lens? Imagine what God could do with this. Maybe I should start praying for, instead of praying for God to remove it, which Paul did three times. But at some point, Paul stopped praying that. And he doesn't spell it out, but what is his prayer? I mean, if he prays three times, that means he stopped. We know he doesn't stop praying, so then how is he going to start praying about this? I think we can infer what he's, show your power through my weakness. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Then I'm strong. Okay, let's move ahead here. So, I guess to summarize, Paul boasts about having received unspeakably great revelation and subsequent thorn of affliction, his weakness. What does it serve? It magnifies Christ and also was for his spiritual good. Okay, need another reader, this time verses 11 through 18 of our text, 11 through 18 of chapter 12. Maybe somebody over here. We had multiple hands shoot up over here. Yeah, Kurt.
I've become foolish. You yourselves compelled me. Actually, I should have been commended by you, for in no respect was I inferior to the most eminent apostles, even though I am nobody. The signs of a true apostle were performed among you with all perseverance, by signs and wonders and miracles. For in what respect were you treated as inferior to the rest of the churches, except that I myself did not become a burden to you? Forgive me this wrong. Here for this third time, I am ready to come to you, and I will not be a burden to you, for I do not seek what is yours, but you. For children are not responsible to save up for their parents, but parents for their children. I will most gladly spend and be expended for your souls. If I love you more, am I to be loved less? But be that as it may, I did not burden you myself. Nevertheless, crafty fellow that I am, I took you in by deceit. Certainly, I have not taken advantage of you through any of those whom I have sent to you, have I? I urged Titus to go, and I sent the brother with him. Titus did not take any advantage of you, did he? Did we not conduct ourselves in the same spirit and walk in the same steps?
All right, thank you, Kurt. So as we've said, Paul is really frustrated, and he's starting to let that out a bit more. You know, of all people who should have been the ones to defend him, these Christians in Corinth should have been among the first to defend him. Instead, he's having to defend himself. And again, to Jesse's point, going to great lengths to need to do so. And he's frustrated about that. In particular, in this section, he seems to be focusing on one particular circumstance or set of circumstances that has created hard feelings or led to hard feelings within the church, that being Paul's decision not to accept pay from them, not to accept financial support from them. And he continues in this section to remain very resolute about that, but he's frustrated that he's being criticized at all about that, about his decision not to accept money from them. For starters, why has he done that? Same reason he's done everything that he's done among the Corinthians. Why has he done it? What? Yeah, so he wouldn't just say it was for their good, right? And for the, you know, more broadly, for the sake of the gospel. You ever tried to so hard to do something right? And this is a foolish, I know what the answer is already. You ever tried so hard to do something right for someone only to perception was reality, just wasn't appreciated, and in fact just garnered you far more trouble than maybe it was worth at some point in your eyes? Ever been there? I mean, the fact that some of you are smiling, I mean, we've been there, right? We get that. A couple of comments up here. Okay.
The New King James, I like the way it says, for your souls, the more abundantly I loved you, the less I was loved.
Let me see that again. I'll be right back.
The more abundantly I love you, the less I am loved.
The more abundantly I love you, the less I am loved. Well, that's a good way of putting it. It's almost like the harder he tries, the worse it gets. Yeah, Steve?
We have an expression in our culture that no good deed goes unpunished.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how he's feeling here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. No good deed goes unpunished. And so instead of being thanked for that, he's accused, and this is a little strange, he's actually accused of somehow in all of this taking advantage of them. Here's one possibility as to what he could be talking about. Perhaps, did you catch my disclaimer? Perhaps the accusation was that Paul was secretly, you remember that relief money for the Judean brethren? So he's not accepting money from the Corinthians. He's collecting money for the needy saints. So maybe he's taken advantage of them in some way there. Maybe he's pocketing that for himself. Again, he's being accused of doing something deceitful, of doing something underhanded. Someone, Elaine?
Psalms 119, 4, it says, in return for my love, they have become my accusers, but I am in prayer against them or for them.
Mm.
And I think this fits here. There's there are so many times when we are, as Paul here is, being accused of something when he's done everything he knows to be good and kind and loving to them.
Right.
And instead of being distressed, we go to God in prayer for it.
Yeah. Paul's, I appreciate that point. Paul, in all of this, do you see, there's tremendous patience on Paul's part. Could just blow up at him. It's like, are you serious, right? I've had enough trouble with you, Corinthians. Have you read that first letter, right? Could go down that road, and yet, I mean, he's just in a very methodical, doesn't seem like the right word, but for lack of a better one, he's just continuing on through this. You know, this is a pretty long letter. I mean, that volume speaks to a measure of patience. He's being very patient with these brethren. He loves them and is glad, Jesse, to your point, he is glad to, in his words, spend and be spent, to exhaust every measure. Here's what he says about all of that. I mean, he uses language that many of us just immediately connect with, and that's the language of parenting. You know, any good parent, would they be eager to have their children do for them? Or, you know, if we're wired like we ought to be, what as parents, what do we want to be the ones who are giving for our children? Now maybe there is a kind of, he's taking a bit of a veiled shot at them here. Maybe, I mean, spiritually, they're still children and not in a good way. And maybe if they grew up a little bit more, Paul might take a different tactic, right? He is concerned for their spiritual good, and something about that has led him to think it would be a burden to, on top of everything else I'm having to do here, to also take pay from them. So I'll take money from the Macedonians, I'll make tents, I'll do whatever. Maybe this is a bit indicting of the Corinthians. I would allow for that. But he is saying, you know, as any good parent, you know, what's wrong with that mindset? So he's using an appeal that I'm sure many in that church could connect with. Any other thoughts about that? It's a very intimate, very passionate appeal that he's making. He expresses frustration over having to defend himself to the Corinthians, and he asserts his not taking pay from them was what any good parent would do. Anyway, trying to find the, okay, here it is. I was thinking of the, given what I just said about maybe maybe there's a mild rebuke in this of the fact that spiritually they're not where they ought to be maturity wise. I don't know. I wouldn't be dogmatic about that. But since I mentioned it, you know, if Paul were to write to us, it's just a thought question. If Paul were to write to us, would there be areas for us where he might say, yeah, you need to mature there or there or there? Just something to reflect on, you know, as we're going through these passages and trying to find lessons for ourselves. Okay, we have one more section here. Beginning in chapter 12 and verse 19, I need someone to start reading there and go through chapter 13 and verse 4. 12:19 through 13:4. I need someone to read. Kurt, you've already read. I appreciate it. Jim, thank you, brother.
All this time you have been thinking that we are defending ourselves to you, Actually, it is in the sight of God that we have been speaking in Christ, and all for your upbuilding, beloved. For I am afraid that perhaps when I come, I may find you to be not what I wish, and may be found by you to be not what you wish, that perhaps there may be strife, jealousy, angry tempers, disputes, slanders, gossip, arrogance, and disturbances. But I am afraid that when I come again, my God may humiliate me before you, and I may mourn over many of those who have sinned in the past and not repented of the impurity, the immorality, and the sensuality which they have practiced. This is the third time that I am coming to you. Every fact is to be confirmed by the testimony of two or three witnesses. I have previously said that when present the second time, and though now absent, I say in advance to those who have sinned in the past and to all the rest as well, that if I come again, I will not spare anyone. Since you are seeking for proof, one of the Christ who speaks in me and who is not weak toward you, but mighty in you. For indeed, he was crucified because of weakness, yet he lives because of the power of God. For we also are weak in him, yet we shall live with him because of the power of God directed toward you.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Okay. So kind of in the vein of being vulnerable, of being willing to express weakness here, Paul really opens up about his fears. Of course, he looks forward to a future visit back in verse 14. He's mentioned it here for the third time. I am ready to come to you. Chapter 13 and verse 1, this is the third time I am coming to you. Chapter 12 and verse 20, I fear that perhaps when I come. So here in this, in these few verses, he has that very much on his mind. This future coming, and he is fearful that coming will not, that visit will not go well. How so? Well, that he will find the Corinthians to not be in a, how would you say it, in a good place. Their spiritual disposition would not be what it should be. And perhaps somewhat to Paul's surprise, to a great extent to his disappointment, because the initial report about the Corinthians from Titus was what about their spiritual state? I mean, it was very good, right? He's heard that the previous letter has hit its mark. It has begun to bear fruit. And Paul is very happy about that. No doubt Titus was as well. So they're rejoicing about that. But he is fearful maybe that'll end up being short-lived. See, one of the dangers of carnality, one of the dangers of looking at things in a worldly way, it becomes far more difficult to separate speaker from message, to separate messenger from message. If the whoever they are, these opponents of Paul, are able to entrap the Corinthians into a carnal way of thinking such that they're looking through, sorry, I'm gonna get my prop, they're looking through the entirely wrong lens in assessing his preaching. The real danger for them is not so much what they will end up thinking about Paul, although listen, that matters because he is an apostle appointed so by Jesus Christ, and listen, that matters. But the even greater danger is that if they're dismissive of Paul, they're going to be dismissive of what else? The message that he has spoken to them, that the things he has spoken in their hearing, the letter that he has written to them previously. A letter that initially seems to have been bearing fruit, but if they get caught up in carnality, they might just throw out the baby with the bathwater, as we say, and just start to be dismissive about all points about which Paul has spoken, because after all, he is not someone who who in their minds would have a lot of credibility, so we don't need to listen to anything. That's a very dangerous path, isn't it? And so someone who has repented of sexual immorality might find that they just return to it. That's why worldliness is such a threat among us. It can stunt our spiritual growth, damage our spiritual vision. You know, when your spiritual vision is damaged, that's an especially dangerous state, because now you can't see that you've got a vision problem. And so Paul is very concerned for them. This will serve to be an unpleasant visit, because in this section, I mean, he's pretty plain. I come with the power of Christ, either to condemn or to praise. And it's really up to them what kind of visit they want this to be. But if they continue on this dangerous course, and they become more and more carnal in their assessment of Paul, and thus drift away from the purity of the gospel, you have a divergence of thinking that is very difficult to bridge. And so when Paul comes, he has told them multiple times, I will be forthright about those who refuse to repent. And I think equally forthright with those who choose to return back to sin. So he's being very vulnerable here and opening up about just exactly what he's worried about. Verse 2 of chapter 13, I warned those who sinned before and all the others, and I warned them now while absent, as I did when present on my second visit, that if I come again, I will not spare them. Verse 3, you want proof that Christ is speaking through me? Is that how you want to get it? Because regardless, he is powerful among you. Christ demonstrated, I mean, Paul's journey here in so many ways mirrors that of Christ. Christ was left heaven, was willing to be regarded as the lowest of the low, took on the form of a servant, was obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Paul likewise is willing to be seen as small and weak and insignificant. But that is just the theater, just the setting for the power of God to shine. Verse 4, for he, Jesus, was crucified in weakness, but lives by the power of God. For we also are weak in him, but in dealing with you, we will live with him by the power of God. Hopefully the Corinthians are saying, all right, whose story here comes closer to mirroring that of Jesus? These accusers who are ready with their papers of recommendation? Or this really not impressive speaker, just seems like a simple man, not terribly impressive by any human measure. Doesn't knock your socks off when he talks. But here's this person, and seems very patient when being wronged. I mean, that's what he's building this case. All right. And he's in many respects, Paul is leaving it up to them to conclude it, because he can't make him conclude one way or the other. Okay, so normally I don't ever get this up here, not this, but the next slide. He's opening up about his fears about the upcoming visit. All right, so again, it's just a question similar to ones we've already asked. But again, I want you to think about your weaknesses. It's very important that you spend time thinking about what your thorns are and meditating on what possibly God could do to use them, specifically to help others who are in sin. Maybe part of your limitation is that your heart has just been beat up by grief. I mean, beat up, beat to a pulp. And you just don't feel nearly as strong in spirit as you used to be. Or maybe it's your health. And, you know, it's one of the things that's unfair about getting older, right? I gotta make sure I don't look at any one person when I say this. But you gain all this wisdom, but then your body starts to break down. You think, man, I wish I had all this energy from when I was young, and then I could use all this wisdom. And maybe there's a purpose in all of that. Maybe God's trying to teach us trust and to get us ready for heaven. All right, we just have one more.